Welcome to the Healing Grove Podcast. I'm Dr. Kristen Ryman, an integrative holistic family physician, author of Life After Lyme, and host in this virtual space of learning, healing, and growing. I believe humans are like trees, and our physical limb is only one of many. Health on all limbs of the tree, emotional, conceptual, social, spiritual, is absolutely required for the whole tree that is you to be vibrantly well. I created the Healing Grove Podcast as a place to showcase some of the world's best integrative and holistic medicine, to expose you to transformative tools and mindset shifts for all limbs of your tree. I hope you enjoy our conversation in the Healing Grove today as much as I enjoyed having it. So hey everyone, hey Healing Grove, and welcome Dr. Emily Kostelnik.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, me too. We've had to reschedule a couple of times. I'm glad that both of us are persistent because this is a really important conversation and I really wanted my community to hear you speak on this topic and really just share your story. I first came across you on Instagram. You share a lot of really, really helpful resources and videos there for people who deal with vestibular or balance issues, dizziness, and the sort of constellation of things that go along with that. And so I wanted my group to get a sense of who you are and hear your story. And you have some tools also to share with us. So I'm excited about
it. Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to dive in.
Awesome. Well, before we dive in, I just want to read so everyone kind of has your background a little bit before we get into it. And then you can fill out the gaps. So
okay.
Dr. Emily Kostelnik is a clinical health psychologist. She specializes in chronic dizziness and related disorders. And she lives herself also with multiple vestibular or balance diagnoses. Over time, she's really learned personally about the connection between histamine intolerance, mast cell activation syndrome, and chronic illness. So I hope we get into that. Some people were talking before the call about how they're dealing with hives. And I said, oh, we might get there today. Emily was founder of Rooted Behavioral Education, which provides self-paced virtual behavioral health courses specific to chronic dizziness. And she also provides one-on-one educational meetings to vestibular warriors worldwide, overseeing vestibular mindset coaches as part of that. She's also the founder of a private psychology practice called The Vestibular Psychologist. And we'll put the links to all of your various things people can find you on after this
okay. conversation.
Online. And there she provides virtual, individual, and group therapy to those with chronic dizziness living in the U.S. states in which she's licensed. And I think it's like 37 states, right?
So I think it's 39 now. The new ones are added all the time. It's hard to keep track.
Amazing. So helpful. Emily's passionate about conducting research, supporting her clients, and providing holistic education to the vestibular community. So if you self-describe as being in that community, I think she is your girl. Her mission is to teach vestibular warriors that treatment requires a whole body approach, which is one of the reasons I wanted her to speak on the Healing Grove podcast, because she really embodies in her work and her philosophy this idea that we're more than just the physical limb of our tree. And she wants people to know that there are always new treatment options to consider, meaning you've never reached the end of the treatment road. There's always something else. So with that, I welcome you. And I would love to have you tell us how you, like, did you wake up one morning and you were like, I'm going to be a vestibular psychologist or
what happened? Not at all. Not at all. So in my graduate training, I was drawn to more of like health psychology, and I'll define that for people, cause I know that's not a term that probably everyone knows, but it's essentially the interplay between medical illness and mental health, which I think are one and the same, but that's the way that kind of it would be described in the field. And so I kind of had a leaning towards health psychology and neuropsychology. And I ended up doing my internship and my postdoctoral training in integrated primary care, which was where I was a behavioral health consultant to physicians within primary care. And it's a really important model. It's mostly done within like veterans hospitals at this point because they're insurance barriers, etc. But I'm a big fan of co-located care because at least in this country, everything, probably most countries, is very siloed with different specialties. And that's later how I kind of became very drawn to functional medicine. So that's sort of my professional background. While I was on my postdoctoral fellowship, my left ear started to feel full all the time. And I saw an ENT and we did kind of conservative allergy treatments, kind of like the things you would think that the roads that they might go down, until things got progressively worse. And I was diagnosed with a very rare vestibular disorder called superior canal dehiscence syndrome. I don't know how much in the weeds you want me to get with this, but essentially it's a physical bony defect in your inner ear. So your inner ear is made up of different balance canals. They are below your brain and something called the temporal bone, which is kind of the bone where your brain sits. And some people can develop very small holes or dehiscences in those bones. And when those bones, when the holes are above balance canals, it causes a whole host of vestibular issues, auditory, dizziness, vertigo, et cetera. So that was kind of my first run-in with the vestibular world. So I actually left my postdoctoral fellowship. I had a middle fossa craniotomy, so a very serious surgery where they cut a hole in my skull above my ear, retracted the temporal lobe of the brain, and tried to plug the hole. And that ended up being unsuccessful. And then I went on to have a second revision surgery. And then kind of fast forward, and that surgery was successful. Fast forward to postpartum, I ended up developing chronic vestibular migraine, which is kind of within the migraine spectrum disorders, but it has to do with dizziness and vertigo and something called persistent postural perceptual dizziness or triple PD. I know there's a lot of kind of jargon coming out here. So that was where for vestibular migraine and triple PD, that's where I started to really dive into the functional realm. So ongoing daily symptoms were dizziness, vertigo, nausea, imbalance. I couldn't drive. I felt like I could barely walk. I had a newborn. I'm a military spouse. My husband was deployed for 6 months. This was during COVID. He came home for a few months, deployed again. So it was kind of like this perfect storm of postpartum period, recovering from a C-section, this vestibular storm, and then a ton of interpersonal kind of psychosocial stressors on top of it. And we had moved multiple times, and I started doing some things that are considered maybe more alternative, but still are towards the conventional side of things like migraine diets and that type of thing. And I felt like I just wasn't really making progress. I started on some medication. I felt like it helped a little bit. But I was hesitant to start adding more medications to treat the side effects of the other medications. And I just thought like there has to be a better way. And that's where I started. I don't even remember how I came across it, but I started to look at the functional approach. And that just spoke to me so much. And it makes so much more sense to me, I guess, of like there's a reason why this is happening. It's not just, this isn't just bad luck. And so I ended up seeing kind of practitioner after practitioner. I felt like I wasn't tolerating anything. So they would have these intensive protocols with all these supplements, and all the supplements had 500 ingredients in them. And I was like, I can't tolerate any of these. And I was kind of constantly met with, like, well, then I can't help you. And so I had to again dig deeper and deeper and deeper until I got to mold. And that kind of like blew everything up for me in terms of thinking of my symptoms differently from a histamine perspective, a mast cell activation perspective, a nervous system dysfunction perspective. And I really had to be my own advocate, my own mold inspector, my own mold tester. I mean, I was ordering labs myself, like trying to put all these pieces together. And so that's kind of like a long-winded answer to say that I feel like the biggest thing that's missing from a lot of treatment is the environmental component. And I really, really strongly believe that's kind of like the future of medicine and where things are going in terms of chronic illness.
Yeah, and well, because it's everywhere. We were actually talking in our little social time before you hopped on about mold. Several of us are remediating in the process of like remediating, inspecting, like, you know, talking through different tips and tricks for that. And someone asked during that time, like, is there anyone who doesn't have mold? And I said, not in my world. Of course, it could be a bias, selection bias. You know, the people who come to me are sick with complex mystery illnesses, and often at the root of that is that they're living in mold, or they have been exposed to mold in the past and haven't healed from that. So, yeah, I'm on the same page as you about that for sure. Can we go back to the part where you were talking about how you did this all yourself, even though you were completely debilitated and your brain? What part
Honestly,
was
I
that?
mean, looking back, like I don't know how I did it. It's the kind of thing where it's like you just rise to the occasion. You know, it's like I had no choice but to function enough to take care of a newborn because when he was around 4 months old is when everything shut down with COVID. And so then I was like, can I even bring like a babysitter in here? You know, like what is that level of risk? So at the time I was living near my parents, so I had some support there. But then from the mold perspective, I remember, I'm trying to think of how that even came to be. I think I was talking to my cousin who's has much more background in this type of approach than I do. And she was like, have you looked into mold? And I hadn't. And so that just sort of was a whole new way of thinking about everything for me.
Yeah. So it's not that long ago that you were totally debilitated. Where are you now? Like, what percent of your best Emily Rockstar self are you today?
So it's an interesting question. So in terms of dizziness, I would say I'm like 100% happy with how I am symptom-wise. So like I live with very, very minimal dizziness. I would say it's not a big part of my life at all. If I have like multiple days of poor sleep, multiple days of significant stressors, I might feel it a tiny bit. But in terms of those symptoms, they're very, very well controlled. The thing that I'm working on now is widening my window of tolerance. So, as I saw these many practitioner after practitioner, I felt like they kept changing my diet to become more and more and more restrictive. And I now know why that's a problem. And to be on like elimination diets for years on end is a problem. And so, I think for me, that has become the biggest issue with food sensitivities, environment, like multiple chemical sensitivity type issues. So I would say like when I'm in my house in my comfort zone, like I feel really good, but now it's about slowly getting my nervous system and immune system to be able to tolerate things better.
Okay, so I have a couple questions. One, I want to get back to elimination diets because we do a lot of that in my community. We do a discrete 21-day elimination diet. Sometimes we extend it if we take out other things. And we're super careful about trying to reset our mindset about when we reintroduce things to, like, it's safe for me to have corn. Corn is good for me. Like doing some tapping, doing some somatic exercises to really sort of program in that this is going to be okay. So I'd love to hear your two cents on that. But first, I want to talk about the other thing that might have just flown out of my mind. So let's talk about the elimination diet first, and then we'll.
So I'm most familiar with like what happens like within migraine vestibular community, but then of course with low histamine diet. So I'll tell you about my personal experience. So I started off on a migraine elimination diet called the Heal Your Headache Diet. It comes from Johns Hopkins. It's essentially low tyramine and low-ish histamine. And I noticed I was reacting to the histamine food. So I remember like eating a spinach and strawberry salad, and like that made me feel really bad, or eating salmon that was like fresh from the grocery store. That made me feel bad. So that kind of alerted me to the histamine piece. So then I started to incorporate more low histamine. But then the next person I saw said you should be doing keto because there's evidence for migraine and epilepsy, et cetera. So then I did low carb. I think my mistake was never adding things back in along the way. So I went from like one elimination diet to the next, and it just got smaller and smaller. So the things that I tried were, again, the Heal Your Headache, low histamine, keto. Then someone else said, no, you need to be on autoimmune paleo. And then gluten-free, dairy-free. And so I'm at a point now where I essentially eat
Chicken and rice.
organic meat, non-starchy vegetables, some like low glycemic fruits. But in terms of what I've seen in my practice and personally, like how I would do things differently, I would say short term is really important. The nervous system piece is so massive because people start to get ideas around what safe foods are and what foods are not safe. And there is so much fear around specific food groups. I think especially people with a history towards perfectionism, more OCD, anxiety, eating disorders, are at much higher risk. I personally have a history of anxiety. And so knowing that now, I'm like, you know, maybe all these restrictive elimination diets should have been handled with more care. So I think that they definitely have a place and can be very powerful, but I think you can also get up to a place where your nervous system is scanning everything for danger. You know, you're reading a label and you're like, nope, 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 nope. Like on to the next, that thing's going to kill me. And it's not even just those, like there's oxalates and lectins and salicylates and like all this whole other world where it's like, if all of these things are bad, then there's nothing left to eat.
Right. So. And let's be real. Some people develop such sensitivities and such that sort of paralyzed fear response that they're like allergic to water. They're reacting to water, which is the basis of all life. So it really does come back to like, how do you reprogram your brain? And I want to go there with you, but I remember my other question. When you use the word widen your window of tolerance, it reminded me of, we had a speaker in the past, Liz Stanley. Are you familiar with her work? Widen the window? So it's interesting because her work is all about, I mean, she had a similar like debilitating in her case, she became blind for a period of time, like was just so debilitated. And ultimately it was about brain retraining, and she's developed a whole brain retraining program called MFIT, right? It's called MFIT, MFFT, I think. But anyway, but she talks about widening the window of tolerance, meaning like widening your window, your capacity to manage stress without going into that kind of like hyper amygdala freakout zone, which is super, you know, not, it can create the symptoms that people are trying to avoid, essentially. And then
and
some.
That the window of tolerance, like that framework comes from trauma work, which I think maps really well onto all of this. And I think like, as I've worked coming from like the traditional medical model, working with veterans, that type of thing, I had a very, I guess, rigid idea of like what trauma meant. And now I think that it's so much broader, and it's really just anything that overwhelms your nervous system and then cognitively your body's ability to cope with it. And so I think dealing with chronic illness and the fear around the medical system and is my doctor going to believe me today and what foods are safe and not safe, that is its own trauma. And so from a window of tolerance perspective, I think trauma is at the core of it, really.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd be curious to know what you feel like your turning points were, because you're clearly so much better and have such a wider window now than you did. Where do you look back on? And I believe complex illnesses are this way. There's no like prescription that everyone can use to go through the path, right? You have to kind of like work a little program and look back and say, is this working? Is this helping, hurting? What do I tweak? Right. Kind of like those PDSA cycles of improvement that they do in business. So I'm wondering if you, as you look back through the retrospectoscope at your own journey, what are the pieces that you look at and you're like, that was a key moment for me, or that practice changed everything?
I think a few things. I think the first thing was changing my conceptualization or mindset around like what was even happening in my body, if that makes sense. So like I went from being like, I have this vestibular migraine issue, that's a genetic thing, and like, if these medications don't work for me, there's like nothing else really that can be done, to a more like, this is a whole mind body systemic issue that has really infinite number of treatments and combinations that can be utilized. So I think that in and of itself was a turning point to think of it differently and to approach treatment differently in that way. So I'd say that was number one. Number two was low-dose naltrexone was very, very helpful for me. And I think thinking of my issues more from an inflammatory perspective was very helpful. So that really helped kind of dampen my background dizziness. The next thing I would say would be moving out of the very, very moldy house into the house that we're in now. And I think mold is its own beast. I know you know this, and probably everyone on this call knows this. It's so challenging from a mindset perspective because it's microscopic, and it's just like, I can't see it, but there's this thing that's trying to harm me. And is it here? Is it not? I don't know. And I think similar to the elimination diets, you can become so incredibly fearful around did I find the right inspector? Did they do it right? Did they do the remediation right? They didn't put up a containment. Oh my gosh, is everything like, has everything gone out the window? Do I get rid of this mattress? Do I clean this mattress? And it's like making all these calculated judgment calls around everything in your life, which again puts you into that same fight or flight.
Well,
So
and
I
there's
think.
no right answer either, right? Like you, it's an uncertainty game. You can't really know. So you're always sort of thinking about the stakes, you know, what's at stake if I get this wrong? And I can't know for sure.
Exactly. And so I think we get into this place of training ourselves to perceive minute levels of danger, of like, is there something microscopic on this shirt or something that I'm going to react to? And I think that that ends up what trains the nervous system and causes the amygdala to kind of grow and cause the limbic dysfunction. But it's all a balance, because it's like, in some ways it's necessary, right, to like be able to live in a lower level of mold and give yourself chance to not be inhaling mycotoxins all the time. But then on the other side of the coin, it's like, what damage am I doing to my perception of fear in the meantime? So I don't know that I necessarily have like the exact right answer for it, because I think I'm still kind of working through it myself. And the reason I had to cancel the first time was because we had a leak the night before. And so it's like, you think after you remediate, then like it's this static, like my house is clean now, but it's totally dynamic and things leak and weather happens. And so it's just this ongoing process. And I think it's about learning to change your relationship with that process.
I love that we're talking about this. And if you had been here for the, you guys were just exactly what we're talking about before the call. We were like, which is more important, the actual mold in your house or your mindset about the mold and your fear level about the mold and the fact that you're not sleeping because you're so freaked out about the mold? And I was telling everyone that so we're in the, also in the process, and I may have canceled once. I canceled on someone recently because we had a leak and then we had to get the whole, you know, kick that whole machine into gear. And remediation was supposed to start yesterday, got pushed off because they're worried that my standards are too high for them to meet. And so I'm like, okay, how do I dial back my standards and not freak the bleep out? So, you know, that whole thing. But it's so interesting to me. And even the inspector who's this sort of like works with medically, you know, mold injured people to create medically clean houses. He's like, I can get you to a zero. And I was like, I sat with that for a week, sort of being like, okay, it's all going to be fine. And then I asked him point blank, how long will my house stay a zero? And he goes, oh, 24 hours. So it's like, what are we doing? You know, it really is about like homeopathic doses to strengthen your body and strengthen your mindset. So fascinating. I'm really glad we're talking about this. Okay, so you have some techniques you wanted to share, and then I want to get into a time when people can ask questions because I'm sure you're going to have a lot of people asking questions. And people want to start throwing questions in the chat just to keep track of them. That's fine, and we'll help you get back to them. But let's hear what you have to share with us.
So I think the thing I wanted to share the most was about acceptance and commitment therapy. It's not something I see discussed that much, like within the functional world. I see a lot of discussion around brain retraining, and I'm familiar with some of the brain retraining programs, and I think a lot of them are based on acceptance and commitment therapy, and which is funny because no one calls it that. And so I just like people to know that like there are other resources out there. There are books if that's for you. There are acceptance and commitment therapy therapists that might be covered by insurance if that's something that would be helpful for you. It's really my favorite modality that I use in my private practice, and I find that people respond better to it than like cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT, which is kind of like the only thing that you hear about, it seems like, especially if you go to like your primary care doctor or a neurologist. It's like the thing they talk about because it has a lot of research on it. So I'll just kind of give kind of like a general overview on it. So acceptance and commitment therapy is a third wave behavior therapy. It was developed in the 1980s. And instead of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the second wave behavior therapy, CBT has us try to change our thoughts. ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, has us change our relationship with our thoughts. And I was talking about the relationship to the mold, the relationship to the thoughts about food, the relationship to the thoughts about I don't know, eating out at a restaurant because they use seed oils or like whatever in your head you decide is like going to kill me. We have to work on changing our relationship with that. So interestingly, it's a bit abstract. I'll try to kind of break it down. The goal of ACT is psychological flexibility and living in service of your values. So the goal is not happiness. It's not sustained happiness because that's a fleeting emotion. It's more around cultivating a life for you that feels fulfilling and purposeful. And so the main kind of main difference or the main thing that they talk about is pain versus suffering. The idea of pain is an unavoidable part of the human experience. So you are training for a marathon, you run down and break your leg, there's pain associated with that. Maybe you have bruising, you need to get a cast, etc. Suffering is all of the language that we put on top of that. So the pain becomes from like this size to this big. So suffering is labeling, it's saying things are good and bad, dangerous, not dangerous. So with my example from the training for a marathon, falling and breaking your leg, the pain would be like quite literally the pain in your leg. Suffering would be I'm never going to be able to run again, my career is over. My partner's not going to want to be with me because this is the thing we have in common, et cetera, et cetera. From a dizziness perspective, the pain would be the dizziness, the vertigo, maybe nausea. The suffering is I'm going to be disabled. I'm going to be in a wheelchair. I'm not going to be able to be a good mom, et cetera, et cetera. And all of the cells in our body are always listening to what we're saying and thinking. And so that narrative is causing your nervous system to activate. So, get fight, flight, freeze, which has a trickle down effect to the way that your stress hormones are released. So, cortisol, adrenaline, when that becomes dysfunctional, it has a trickle down effect to the way that your sex hormones are created or not created. And then that can get out of balance and ultimately to the immune system and can lead to chronic systemic inflammation. And so I think from a histamine, I know we didn't get too much into histamine mast cell perspective, quite literally, the way that we're thinking and the things we're telling ourselves can cause more histamine to be released, can cause more inflammatory mediators to be released. And I think the kind of mindset, nervous system, somatic piece of all of it is so nebulous that it can kind of fall by the wayside because it feels more concrete to like take a supplement or take a medication. And I really believe that these practices, nervous system and otherwise, are so as important as all of the other things. And so, what ACT would say is that the root of human suffering is in language. It's the way that we label things as good and bad. I mean, if you think of even one word, they have an exercise called the milk exercise. We're not going to do it because it takes a little bit of time. But the idea is even just the word milk, you have an entire neural network around what that means. Like maybe for you, that means yum or yuck. It's white, cow, cheese, ice cream, like all these things. And then when you use words that are more maybe emotionally triggering or emotionally charged for you around your illness, you have that same neural network and your body learns to respond in the same way. And it just becomes the same loop. And so we have to figure out how to kind of intervene on that. So there's a bunch of different exercises to do. One of them is called. It comes from something called cognitive fusion or cognitive defusion. So the idea is with cognitive fusion, we become kind of one and the same with our thoughts. So we're looking at the world from our thoughts rather than being able to look at our thoughts with curiosity. And so one exercise I can run you through really quickly is called Leaves on a Stream. So if you're comfortable closing your eyes, I will invite you to do so. I'm sorry that my 4-year-old is screaming in the background. So get comfortable, close your eyes, and I want you to imagine a stream. And that might be a stream that's familiar for you, a place you've been before, or it can be somewhere that's totally new, just something that you can create in your mind's eye. And I want you to imagine maybe it's the fall, the wind is blowing, and the leaves are blowing off of the trees and landing on the stream and floating down the stream. And I want you to take a few minutes to now change your attention to your thoughts. Could be anything. It could be maybe words are coming to mind. Maybe images are coming to mind. Maybe colors are coming to mind. I want you to physically pick that up and put it on the leaf and let it just trickle down the stream. The goal here is not that we're sending it away. We're not trying to get rid of it. We're just trying to observe it. This is called cognitive defusion. So we're going from a place of cognitive fusion where we are our thoughts to cognitive defusion where we can just recognize thoughts are just these behaviors that we can observe. So I'll give you about a minute of quiet and just try to tune in. And if you find your mind wandering, perfectly fine, just bring it back and just see how you do with trying to take those thoughts, images, colors, whatever comes to your mind and put them on the stream to create a little bit of space. All right, so we'll just come back into the room here. If you have a meditation background, it might have felt pretty familiar. If not, people can say that it's very difficult. It's hard to kind of keep their attention on it. Sometimes it's hard to even know what am I thinking if that's not a usual practice for you. So someone, I think in the chat, said it's reminding her of Buddhism. So act is very much comes from Eastern philosophy. So that doesn't surprise me at all. I like to see that. I can leave you with one last little exercise that I like, which is called dropping anchor. And the idea is that, again, metaphor, if you are a boat in water and you feel like you're getting kind of swept out to sea, maybe these symptoms, sensations, thoughts are feeling like too much, you can drop anchor. And the acronym is ACE. So the first is acknowledge. So maybe you're like, oh, like I'm getting into territory where my thoughts have become unhelpful. I'm down a rabbit hole. I'm thinking about the mold remediation going on the third story, whatever it is. So that's the A for acknowledge. The C is connect. So reconnect with your body. That might be taking a deep breath. It might be smiling, even fake smiles increase the amount of dopamine in your body, which is pretty interesting. And then E is engage. So engage in whatever it was that you were doing. You were probably on autopilot with whatever you were doing. So engage in a mindful way, perhaps focusing on your five senses. So let's say, I'll give an example. Let's say I'm cooking dinner, and there's something popping into my head about, I'm a military spouse. So this is the first thing in my head of like, this is so much work. My husband's never here. This is so unfair. I have to do all the household chores. Not helpful, right? That just gets me into a place where I can't engage effectively, like with my son or the work that I need to do. So connecting would be taking a deep breath. The whole point is disrupting kind of that same thought pattern. And then engaging would be noticing my feet on the ground. It would be noticing kind of how the spoon feels in my hand, maybe smelling the food, tasting the food, noticing what I'm hearing. So it's really bringing you back to the present moment, because typically the present moment is okay if we can become aware of our surroundings. Where we get into more troublesome territory is when we start projecting about what that means about us, what that means about the future.
I love this. It's really, we talk a lot in here in the Healing Grove about the five limbs of the tree, with one limb being the physical limb, which is where a lot of people spend a lot of time kind of with symptoms and sensations. But the conceptual or mental limb of the tree is really the monkey mind is making all sorts of mischief all the time, unless we rein it in and kind of retrain it to go where we want and to think what we want to think.
Yes.
It's really a discipline. It's really a practice.
It really is. And it requires a ton. I mean, anything neuroplasticity related requires a ton of repetition and consistency.
Yeah. It's like flexing the muscles of okayness again and again until they flex on their own. And you just really feel like you're okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you have had experience with primal trust. It's one of the sort of newer kids on the block in terms of the neural retraining, the limbic retraining programs.
I've heard of it. I haven't had a chance to dig into it myself, but I'm definitely very curious about it. I have heard complaints of the kind of limbic retraining programs as being too cognitive and not having enough of a somatic approach, which I agree with. Like, I find that my training was very cognitive, and it leaves a huge gaping hole for a lot of people of like, okay, cognitively, I know that maybe these thoughts are irrational or unhelpful for me, but like my body is saying otherwise. And so I think tackling the somatic piece is really important. And it does Primal Trust do more of that?
That's really, I think, part, because I had leaned into DNRS and Gupta, just trying to sort of learn what these tools are and what programs are. Those two do feel very heady to me. And if you're not buying into their specific tool or like feeling it, you know, for meditation, for example, for Gupta, then it's kind of not your jam. But Primal Trust has kind of something for everybody. And they build in a lot of practice sessions over the week that are all just optional that you can pop into and get 20 minutes, you know, tapping, or 20 minutes of like vocalizing or vagal nerve toning or ecstatic dancing, or, you know, kind of all the different things that they're giving you as their smorgasbord. But, and they have the cognitive piece as well. She does a lot of teaching in the modules, but those are self-paced and you can kind of take it at your own. I think it's sort of more in alignment with the way I think about things and the utility for my patient population.
Yeah, no, it sounds great.
Yeah. So I wonder if you would share a little bit about your mast cell journey, because we haven't actually had anyone on the Healing Grove podcast or in our membership yet talk to us specifically about mast cells. And I know you've had a lot of experiential learning with that. And I wonder if you could kind of download some of your pearls that you've learned along the way.
Yeah. I think when I was first introduced to the idea of it, I had this thought in my head that like mast activation syndrome had to be the most extreme. You had to be experiencing anaphylaxis and that type of thing. And so in my head, I was like, that's not me, so I must not have that. But once I came to a sort of more balanced way of thinking about it, of like a multi-systemic, multi-symptom kind of exists on a continuum type thing, I thought that it ended up fitting really well for me. So I would say with mast cell issues, the way that I think about it is, I think that these underlying issues, so like mold, chronic infections, trauma, whatever might cause our mast cells to be more overactive, tend to show themselves in areas of weakness, like within our bodies. And so it made sense for me that my vestibular system was weaker, since I had these two surgeries, I had this physical defect, I have a migraine history in my family. And so thinking of it in that way, I think really helped me. And then once I started trialing different medications and supplements that I knew were attacking it from that angle and seeing benefit with them, it kind of like confirmed that for me. So some more antihistamine type supplements, so like ginger has been really helpful for me. Vitamin C, Chinese skullcap are ones that come to mind. Butyrate. There's a new one called Holoimmune I'm taking. It's a paraprobiotic that helps modulate the immune system. And then mast cell stabilizers, so like ketotifen, H1 blockers, like Claritin is helpful for me. And so when I started taking these medications that like my neurologist or my ENT never recommended for chronic dizziness, and I saw that it had an impact, I was like, okay, that must be addressing like what's actually going on and like causing all this histamine and other inflammatory mediators release and making me feel so miserable. And so I think that just helps me conceptualize the same thing of like, if I walk down the detergent aisle, why that gives me a headache or why that makes me feel dizzy. It's like my mast cells, my gatekeepers, are just trying to protect me and saying like, danger, I don't want anything new like in the castle. So I think that's sort of how I've conceptualized it and confirmed over time that I think that that's my issue. I mean, I've never had like, I know they're not even really good blood markers for it. I had one naturopath once who tested my serum tryptase and said because it was normal I didn't have MCAS, and I was like, I don't think that's true. I think I saw it's like 80% of people with MCAS abnormal tryptase. So I think it's just, and conceptualizing it just as more of a clinical diagnosis rather than like we're relying on this blood test and like that means that you have it. So I hope that answers your question.
No, it's a really good beginning. I think to back up a little bit for people who don't know what a mast cell is. So it's a part of your white, it's a part of your innate immune system. Emily mentioned being a gatekeeper. They're sort of like on the front line of defense. And so they're sort of, you know, moving through the blood and the tissues, and they've got little bags of histamine and like a thousand other, you know, different granules that they could dump on things that create, basically invoke a bigger immune response. So if they find something foreign that they think is going to be harmful to the host, to us, they will start to dump their histamine and other things to bring in the troops, to bring in the other immune cells. And it creates inflammation and swelling and redness and heat and all the cardinal signs of inflammation, right? Which if it's in your vestibular system, could mean you become dizzy, right? If it's in your stomach, it could mean you have aches and pains and don't want to eat food, or you feel nauseous after eating. So depending on, like you said, your area of weakness or where they tend to congregate, that's going to be where your symptoms might be. And what I find fascinating about this, I'd love to hear your thoughts about why this is, but this is like kind of a new conversation in the last 7 years, right? Like mast cell activation syndrome, mast cell disorders weren't really talked about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I have my hypotheses, but I'd love to hear why you think that is. I suspect it's the same.
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind just within the past, I guess, 4 years would be COVID and long COVID, and just how many people have been impacted by that. And I've seen papers where they're hypothesizing that long COVID is a mast cell activation issue. I think if we're thinking more like you're saying, maybe more like 10 years ago, it's been talked about. I haven't really thought about that. I think that I see kind of a movement, away from conventional medicine. Maybe that's just, again, my own selection bias, because that's who I see and that's like the lens that I take now. But I know the CDC has like these astounding numbers of people with chronic illness and multiple chronic illnesses. And when you're repeatedly failed by a medical system, you start to look for answers elsewhere. And so I think that as people look for answers from more alternative doctors and more experimental type things, it kind of gains traction and becomes its own movement, just as I guess supply and demand of like what people are looking for and the information they're looking at. I think I was first introduced to it probably like by Neil Nathan and reading his book Toxic. I'm a big fan of his work and try to follow like the podcasts and stuff that he's on. But yeah, what are your thoughts about why it's getting more attention?
I think it has to do with, like you said, the number of people impacted by it. And I think I don't think it's a diagnosis issue. I don't think 20 years ago, we had all these people who were struggling with MCAS symptoms that were sort of hiding. I don't think that's the case. I think that we are living in an increasingly toxic world and an increasingly traumatized world. And we're not managing, you know, we are not widening our window collectively and individually in a way that will allow us to manage those things without symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Stress plus toxicity plus not having the tools to heal those things.
Yes, I think that for sure. I think as things become more toxic and we become more socially isolated, as the soil becomes more depleted and nutrient deficiencies become more rampant, it's just like the perfect storm, really. And yeah, I mean, I've been in Facebook groups where there are kids that can't even go outside without getting hives. They can tolerate like one food, and people have to look for answers somewhere, right? So it's actually quite frightening.
I want to mention one thing. I don't know if you've seen, Neil Nathan has a new book out, The Sensitive Patient's Healing
Guide. I was waiting for, is it out yet? I didn't know if it was out.
Put the link on it. The Amazon link is in the chat.
Oh, cool.
I got an early copy. I'm in his mentorship program with Jill Krista. And as a result, I was able to get an early copy, and it's amazing. It's amazing. It's actually a collaborative effort. So he has interviewed and collaborated on chapters, basically looking at all the different pieces that go into someone becoming a highly sensitive person, or a clinically sensitive person, chemically sensitive. And, they all have pieces. So like Annie Hopper has a chapter in there, and Ashok Gupta has a chapter in there, and he's got like 20 other people who he's like kind of brought in the thought leaders in each of their specialties. It's a beautiful, I mean, just the fact that he did that is, I think, so beautiful, you know, such a great modeling of collaboration and sharing and like humble learning. You know, he's such a humble learner.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really helpful resource. I think it will be a very helpful resource for people.
Awesome. I'm excited to read it.
Cool. And also, if people wanted to work with you, you still, right? You do that outside of the states that you're licensed in through your other programs, correct? So there's a couple different ways to work with you.
So, yeah. So I do, for the people outside of the states where I'm licensed, I do one-time consultations. I don't do like ongoing coaching just because I don't have the capacity for it. But through my private practice, I do individual therapy and one-time consultations. And I would say I use an eclectic approach to leaning much more towards ACT. And I use things like biofeedback. I'm a big fan of tapping, and I'm starting to incorporate more like somatic modalities as well.
Beautiful. So we'll include links to get in touch with you for people afterwards too.
Okay.
Just in these last few seconds, I want to really, really express my gratitude to you, Emily. I'm so grateful that I found you on Instagram, and I'm so grateful for all that you are doing. I feel like you're putting out a message that's so compassionate and so authentic and so helpful for so many people. And it's really going to make a difference in the world. So thank you for everything
thank
that you're
you.
Doing.
Thank you so much for having me. And I mean, likewise, like I love the work that you do. I love the holistic approach. I love this healing grove. So I would love to keep in touch.
Yeah, for sure. More to come.
All right.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Healing Grove podcast. If you liked it, please be sure to like and subscribe. And if you want to deepen your experience further, consider grabbing a copy of the Healing Grove playbook. With journal prompts for this podcast and 41 others, it's the perfect place to record your learnings, keep track of the tools you explore, and reflect on your own experience. Finally, it's important to mention that even though I am a doctor, nothing you hear on this podcast, whether from myself or my guests, constitutes medical advice. Any intervention you try should always be discussed with and supervised by a trusted member of your own healing team. Thanks for listening, and see you next time in the Healing Grove.